Good day, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to the NTPC Media Briefing conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star one on your telephone keypad. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Assistant Vice President of Communication for National Pork Producers Council, Mr. Jim Monroe. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Mayville, and thanks to all of you for joining us today. NTPC's members have had a busy week meeting with lawmakers, and we really appreciate the chance to brief you on the focus of those discussions. Hopefully, you've received a copy of the press release providing more detail on the priority issues for this week's Legislative Action Conference. If not, don't hesitate to get in touch with me or Rachel Gantz, and we'd be happy to get that to you. On the line today are NTPC's officers, including President Jen Sorensen from Iowa, President-elect Terry Walters from Minnesota, and Vice President Scott Hayes from Missouri. We also have several NTPC staff members, including CEO Neil Dirks, Nick Giordano, Vice President and Counsel of Global Government Affairs, Michael Formica, Assistant Vice President, Domestic Policy and General Counsel, Dr. Liz Wagstrom, Chief Veterinarian, Andrew Bailey, Science and Technology Counsel, Maria Ziba, Assistant Vice President, International Affairs, and Jack Detevo, Manager of Labor and Other Issues. We'll start with remarks from NTPC President Jen Sorensen, and then we're going to move right to Q&A. And just a reminder for the NTPC team, when we get to Q&A, please identify yourself when responding so folks on the phone can track comments and how to attribute them. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Jen.
Thanks so much, Jim. Good afternoon and hello to everyone on the call. And thank you for your interest in NTPC's Legislative Action Conference. As Jim pointed out, this week, U.S. producers have been meeting with their representatives in Congress to address five priority issues. Let's start with trade, which is always a top priority for our industry. Vietnam represents one of U.S. pork's best near-term export market opportunities. Unfortunately, the United States faces several unwarranted tariff and non-tariff barriers that prevent us from supplying this major pork-consuming nation, which right now is dealing with African swine fever and its domestic herd. It's preventing the U.S. from supplying affordable, high-quality pork. Domestic pork consumption in Vietnam is greater than 2.5 million metric tons per year, yet last year it only imported 25,000 metric tons of U.S. pork. Our producers have been asking members of Congress to work with the U.S. Trade Representative on efforts to enhance Vietnamese market access for U.S. pork. In our meetings with members of the House, we urge representatives to sign a letter co-sponsored by Representatives Ron Kine, Darren LaHood, Dusty Johnson, and Jim Costa, the U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai, seeking her support for enhanced Vietnamese market access. Another top priority is addressing the significant labor shortage in the pork sector, both on our farms and in plants. U.S. pork producers offer jobs with good pay and benefits, but most Americans simply do not live near our hog farms or harvest facilities, and rural populations continue to decline, causing us to be largely dependent more and more on foreign-born workers. Unfortunately, current visa programs fail to address the workforce needs of U.S. pork producers and other year-round livestock farmers. Pork producers are asking members of Congress to address labor reform that both opens the H-2A visa program to year-round labor without a cap and provides legal status for agricultural workers already in the country. NTPC also addressed three critical animal health-related issues with lawmakers this week. They include, number one, full congressionally appropriated funding, $635 million, or 720 new U.S. Customs and Border Protection agriculture inspectors as authorized by 2020 legislation to keep American agriculture safe from foreign animal and plant diseases. Number two, appropriations of $30 million as authorized by Congress for the National Animal Laboratory Network, which provides disease surveillance and diagnostic support in cases of large-scale animal disease outbreaks. And number three, tighter USDA regulation for the safe importation of rescue dogs from foreign animal disease positive countries to protect U.S. livestock. Before we open the line for questions, I want to mention how excited we are to be holding the World Pork Expo this June after a two-year hiatus. The event, which is the world's largest pork industry-specific trade show, is scheduled June 9th through 11th at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. Please know that all appropriate actions will be taken to support both human and animal health. And as a note, media are required to register. So for more information or to register, anyone can visit worldpork.org. At this time, I'll ask the operator to please open the line for questions.
All right, to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. First question comes from the line of Mr. Mike Dorning. Can you state your media organization?
Sure. This is Mike Dorning with Bloomberg News. I just had a question about California's Proposition 12 law, which I know you're arguing against. I was wondering if you have any sense whether any farmers are making renovations or other adjustments in their practices to make room for more room for sows or other meet other requirements of the law. To what extent is the pork industry changing practices to fit the law?
Michael Formica, do you want to take that one?
Sure, Jim. I will. I can try and answer part of it. And you know, you're right. We are definitely we're challenging Prop 12 in court. We had oral arguments yesterday before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we'll be cautiously optimistic, waiting for how those resolve. At the same time, we've also been deeply engaged with the state of California, trying to both help educate them about the hurdles Prop 12 causes for pork producers, and you know, and weigh in with them on what is and isn't feasible for pork producers to changes to make to their farm. One of our big concerns beyond just Prop 12 itself is that under Prop 12, California was supposed to release final regulation back in September 1 of 2019. It's now April of 2021. Prop 12 contemplated and expected we'd have over 2 years after those regulations to come out to figure out how to comply. And California has not even proposed regulations yet. And that's causing a lot of concern within the industry. And it's probably one of the reasons that more producers haven't started making investments. There's a lot of discussion out in the countryside. A lot of people, we get more questions on Prop 12 than maybe anything else. A lot of producers are looking at options. We hear about a lot of hackers are looking at options. But as the recent Rabobank report that came out a couple of weeks ago indicated, that there has not been a lot of conversion going on, that there are there's real likely to be some lag in when those conversions happen, because producers don't know what the court case is going to say, and they don't know what these California regulations are going to require. I don't know if anyone else has anything else to add to that. If any of the producers on the call have anything they want to add.
Jen,
go ahead.
Yep, Michael, thanks. This is Jen Sorensen. I would just reiterate again the uncertainty surrounding Prop 12 right now has put all U.S. producers in such a challenging position. It will cost individual producers, millions of dollars to make these changes. And the ones, least able to bear that cost, sadly, will be small family farms. So loss of this market will put many hog farmers out of business and ultimately lead to further industry consolidation. So I think the word is uncertainty, Michael, and you hit it well. We're in a space where we don't have clarity. The risk is tremendous. The financial burden is tremendous.
And so pork producers and the pork industry is going to be hurt, but they're not the only ones who are going to be hurt. Residents of California are going to be hurt. They've got 40 million people living there. They have, by sheer numbers, the highest number of people in any state living under the poverty level. We're coming out of this horrific COVID crisis. The economy's in shambles, and Prop 12 is going to remove the protein of choice for 55-60% of California residents today is going to be removed as a low cost option. The pork that they will have is going to be significantly more expensive there, and so Prop 12 will hurt and is hurting hog farmers, but Prop 12 is also going to hurt moms and children and families living in California.
Okay. Unless there's any other comments from the NPPC team, Mike, thanks for that question. Okay. And we'll go to the next one.
All right, as a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Next question comes from the line of Jerry Hagstorm. Please state your media organization before asking your question.
Yes, this is Jerry Hagstorm with the Hagstorm Report. Can you hear me?
We can, Jerry.
I guess. Okay, yep. Great. I have a question about the Pork Expo and the health regulations. My first question is whether you have any knowledge of whether pork producers are getting vaccinated. We've heard so much about farm workers, and we've heard about meat plant workers, food processing workers, but we also hear there's more resistance to the vaccine in rural America, but I haven't seen anything about farmers in particular. So I'm wondering if you have any sense of that among your members. And the second thing is, in terms of these health regulations for the World Pork Expo, can you give us any details? Are you going to require proof of vaccine or a negative test or temperature checks? Anything else?
I'll start. This is Jim Monroe, and I'll start with your first question. I don't know that there's any real way we can know, the rate of vaccinations out in rural communities. I can tell you that NPPC has been very active in promoting the COVID vaccine. We have a campaign, You're Essential, So It's Essential, that we've been driving through social media and through other channels to encourage folks in our industry to get the COVID vaccine. USDA has been obviously very active on that front as well. I think for any other comments, I would turn it over to our officers, our producers, to see if they have any color they can provide. Jen, anything from you?
Yeah, this decision did not come lightly. It was very carefully considered, based on the feedback of so many across the industry, not only the board of directors, you know, but also within the state of Iowa. To move forward with the World Pork Expo this year, it's our industry's biggest event, a place where producers and industry participants get together and do business and look at new products, adopt innovations, learn from each other, otherwise network. So we're continuing to monitor appropriate safety measures in accordance with federal, state, and local guidance. Committed to remaining vigilant in monitoring conditions and responding accordingly.
Can you still hear me?
Jerry, thanks for the question. Jerry, anything else?
Can you still hear me? Well, yep, I was just going to say, would it be accurate to say that the exact safety measures have not been announced yet and they're going to depend on recommendations from the CDC between now and June?
Well, there will certainly be, you know, there's measures we already know we're going to take. For example, we have a trade show, which is going to be, you know, more spread out with barriers between exhibit space and stuff like that, hand washing stations and the like. And obviously, urging other practices encouraged by the CDC. And as Jen said, we'll continue to monitor the situation and guidance from government officials, and we will adjust appropriately.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. Mayville, next question.
Jim, I would say, Jim, this is Terry. I can certainly jump on to add to Jerry's question there, but I would just say from our sector that here in Southwest Minnesota and other producers I'm talking to, definitely the outreach to employees and workers. We provide locations where vaccines are available. We are continuing to put that information in front of all our team and definitely encouraging employees and staff, et cetera, along with fellow producers to get vaccinated. So I would say it's a definite support from the producer ownership sector to have employees and people vaccinated.
Thank you, Terry.
All right, next question comes from the line of Ellen Ferguson. Please state your media organization before asking your question.
Ferguson, CQ Roll Call. And two questions. One, piggybacking on Jerry's question, do you have any kind of anecdotal sort of response from producers as to whether they are willing to get vaccinated? You talk about the push to get employees vaccinated. Have you heard any kind of feedback from what producers think about getting themselves vaccinated? And then two, on Vietnam, are you asking the USTR to take some sort of trade enforcement action on Vietnam because of the trade barriers, or are you asking them just to kind of nudge them?
Hey, Jim, this is Neil. May I make a comment?
Please.
I would just, on the first part of your question, I would just say, and this is, of course, has to be anecdotal because I don't have empirical data. I will tell you the sense I have, and I talk to a lot of producers, is that producers are getting vaccinated. And I am trying to think, but I don't recall any significant pushback by a producer that about not getting vaccinated. And part of that, I think, is the culture of our industry. And Terry and Jen and Scott can give a perspective. But our producers are used to dealing with animal health, and they understand the importance of vaccines. Now, I'm sure that there are some producers that will not want to be vaccinated. But more often than not, when I talk to a producer, I get comments like, well, I just had my second booster, or I am getting vaccinated this day. So just a perspective. And that was from Neil Dirks, the CEO of MPPC. I don't know if there are any other comments, Jim, but then we can get into this question on trade.
Okay. Thank you for that, Neil. Does anyone else want to address the first question before we go to Vietnam?
Jim, this is Terry again. I can just say that I have been vaccinated. I've had both my doses. Much like Neil's comments, I have yet to talk to a producer that has told me no, they have no interest in getting vaccinated, that they won't support it. I think you're spot on, Neil. We care for livestock every day. It's part of our daily routine to vaccinate and prevent disease. So I would say majority of our people are on board with it.
Thank you. All right, Vietnam now.
Okay, Maria Ziba, yes. Do you want to address that?
Sure, I'll take a crack at that. All we're asking for is for USTR, for Ambassador Thai, to engage with the Vietnamese during their conversations and to, in the context of the conversations that are already happening around those trade cases, that tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade be eliminated. We think that there's a lot that can be accomplished in those negotiations, and we just want to be part of the conversation.
Is there any kind of timetable?
This is Nick Giordano. Let me follow up on Maria's comments. I've been with the organization 25 years. I'm trained as a trade lawyer. This is how we operate. We tell the U.S. government, hey, we can sell a lot of U.S. pork in X market, but we have issues there. In the case of Vietnam, unfortunately for them, they have African swine fever. A lot of countries in Asia do. And we've always known that Vietnam was going to be a really good market for us. And this disease has pulled forward a lot of that demand. Unfortunately, we're at a disadvantage to the CPTPP countries and to the European Union, who basically got the deal that we negotiated in CPTPP. So last year, the Vietnamese rolled back the duties on our product, so we were at parity. That really helped us a lot, and that expired at the end of the year. So we're hoping that Ambassador Thai and her team, the administration, push forward. There's a lot of opportunity. The U.S. has a trade imbalance with Vietnam, and pork alone is a great candidate to put a dent in that trade imbalance. So we're pretty optimistic. We've got bipartisan support on the Hill. We're pretty optimistic that the U.S. government already is taking this request very seriously.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. Next question, please.
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Next question comes from the line of Matt Kay. Please state your media organization before asking your question.
This is Matt Kay at the Burns Bureau. Maybe Nick could take this up or someone else who deals with trade. But the question is this. The NPPC has been dealing with the Taiwan and pork ractopamine issue for many years. We all know that Taiwan has eased its restrictions on pork treated with ractopamine. But the imports, I understand, have not been that significant. Now Taiwan is going to have a referendum that might roll back those reforms, a referendum coming up in August. Meantime, the President Biden, has sent a high-level delegation this week to Taiwan, including former State Department diplomats and former U.S. Senator Chris Dodd. They met with President Tsai, talked about restarting trade talks, as well as security and climate issues. But the president of Taiwan is saying that she's optimistic about at least resuming talks on the trade and investment framework agreement, maybe later bilateral. But how are you approaching this with USTR in the current environment with limited imports by Taiwan and public sentiment still heavily weighted against pork treated with ractopamine?
Mike, our position on ractopamine is no different than our position on how hogs are raised. We believe in the freedom to operate and the producer's freedom to make decisions about the production process they use, how they raise the hogs, the tools they use in the production process. We talked earlier about Proposition 12. We're opposed to mandates, whether they come from federal government, state government, local government, or foreign governments. So our position is unchanged. We want the Taiwanese to recognize what the United States government recognizes and most of our trading partners recognize, which is U.S. pork is safe, wholesome. Frankly, we think it's second to none in terms of safety and quality. It's affordable. We don't particularly appreciate it when our product is disparaged. And we're hopeful that negotiations between the United States and Taiwan come to a point where there's no longer stigma on U.S. pork, and we're not attacked in the media, and consumers in Taiwan have the same choice that consumers in the United States and in most of our export markets have, which is to enjoy safe, high-quality U.S. pork.
Now, the question for the U.S. is whether to restart any negotiations. Is your organization opposing restarting negotiations until the Taiwanese start to import U.S. pork?
Mike, you want me to tell you all my secrets here? I really.
I know you've opposed talks until they import some of your product.
Let's just put it this way: it's a difficult situation, and we're working on it closely with the administration. Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Next question, Mayville.
Next question comes from the line of Janine Otto from Shaw Media. Janine, your line is open.
Thank you very much. This is Janine Otto from Shaw Media, which is also AgriNews Publications now. Just a quick question to clarify. When you say regarding Prop 12, so I apologize for going back to that, but when you say small farms will be put out of business or affected, or pork producers, who are we talking about? Are we talking about independent pork producers? Are we talking about the folks paying off loans on finishing barns? I mean, are there specifics to that demographic that you're referencing?
Hey, this is Nick Giordano. Let me take the first crack at that before we turn it over to the producers and Michael Formica, who's the expert. Look, almost any time you have a government mandate, the big folks are usually the ones that are best situated to flip the bill for the cost of regulation. So our position has never been that, you know, all regulation is bad. Of course not. But we're for science-based, commercially reasonable regulation. And often what happens is in some of these issues, you know, it's very well-meaning, but what happens is the strong survive, it drives consolidation, and it hurts smaller producers. And it's not just on an issue like Prop 12. There are lots of issues where that's the dynamic, where you'll have policymakers who are really trying they say they're trying to drive more competition and create more opportunity, but often what happens is it's the strong, the big, the moneyed that are able to flip the bill of compliance.
Okay, but I appreciate the answer, Nick, so thank you for that. And I understand that, but I mean, when you're talking about that demographic who would be most impacted by this, who is that? I mean, is there a
size?
Is there a herd size?
Sure. No. So this is Michael from AQ. So right off the bat, you know, if you had the people with access to capital are going to be the ones who either can go in and retrofit. And if you have a barn, if you have a sow facility that you've built, you got a barn with 5,000 sows and you just built it 3 years ago, there's no way you're going to be able to go to your banker and say, oh, now I gotta shut down my farm. I've got to clean all of the interior equipment out and completely retrofit that. So that's a smaller size producer. You're going to have trouble with that. All of the contract finishers who are relying on piglets coming from that sow farm are also going to be hurt, because even if they've retrofitted, now, you know, let's say they're lucky and they only have to have a 20% decrease in production, because that's what, if you're going from 17 or 18 square feet to 24 square feet, that's what you're talking about. You're having fewer pigs coming out of that system. And so now there are finishing farms that are going to be short on pigs. There's not going to be enough piglets for them. And so they're going to suffer as well. The entire chain will suffer. And who will prevail? It's going to be economies of scale. Those larger producers who have access to capital, who have access to credit, and can afford to go out and either construct a brand new farm, or have the ability to take a farm that's got excess capacity, and they can take a farm out of operation and completely retrofit it. I don't know if the producers on this call want to weigh in as well.
Jim, this is Terry again. I would just say that the other part that adds to that, to your point, remodeling is a option, but you're dealing with increasing your footprint another 25%. Building costs and materials are in the neighborhood of 30 and 40% higher than they were. Availability, I know several projects that have been put on hold because they can't access materials to even do projects if you were considering it. The other part that is challenging about this proposition is we sell parts and pieces of a pig all over the country, all over the globe. We don't just send a specific number of pigs to California. They consume 14 or 15% of the product, but they don't take them in full pigs. So it is an interesting dynamic that pieces of the pigs will have to be sold at a discount in the event we can get a premium for the pigs or parts that go to California. So it does create a very complex dynamic in the food chain.
Okay, thank you,
Janine.
And Michael, just add, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is Neil Dirks again. All this being said, with no clear regulatory framework to
that,
date.
That's correct, Neil. No clear regulations yet. No proposed regulations yet, let alone final regulations.
Okay, thank you all. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Janine. Next question,
all right,
please.
As a reminder, again, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Next question comes from the line of Chuck Abbott from Food Environment. Chuck, your line is open.
Hi, I'm Chuck Abbott with Food and Environment Reporting Network. Staying in California, California is the biggest state by population in the country. 12% of Americans live in California. Proposition 12 passed by a landslide vote in California. How do you explain to Californians that your response to their concerns about animal welfare is, we just don't care, we're going to do it our way because it's cheaper?
Michael, you want to start with that?
Sure. That has not been our response to them. Our response is, well, first of all, it's a ballot initiative, right? And so let's be honest. People go to the go to the polls. And I've been out to California far more, you know, far more in the last 3 or 4 years than I went the rest of my life. And every time I'm out there, I ask everyone I run into if they know about this issue. And to a person, not a single individual knew anything about this. And, but yet it passes because it's a ballot initiative and it's phrased a certain way. If somebody does eventually remember it, they think it's about eggs because that's how it was sold to California, that this was a cage-free egg standard. And I get that, and I get their concerns, but they certainly didn't read the 79-page voter guide. When they're answering this question on the ballot, they don't know what the details of the regulation. The devil is in the details. And so, yes, we want animals to be, you know, to be treated with care. We don't want them to be treated cruelly. Our pork producers don't want the animals to be treated cruelly. But do they know what that means? Do they know if the actions that they're asking for are actually in the best interest of that animal? And, you know, people who work with the animals, raise the animals, have built their livelihoods around, you know, managing these animals, happen to be in, you know, have decades of experience, generations of experience, happen to be in a position where they just might have a little bit more knowledge as to what is and isn't in the best interest of an animal than somebody in a state 2,000 miles away who's never been on a hog farm. So there's that. But we're not saying we don't care what your interests are. We are saying that if you're going to do something, it needs to be first consistent and compliant with the Constitution. It needs to be, as Nick said earlier, based on science. It needs to be based on an understanding of, you know, of veterinary care and of the needs of that animal. And it needs to be based on the you know, the realities of the marketplace as it is. We also need, if we're being asked to make wholesale changes to the industry, massive changes, it would be nice to have some time, reasonable time, to make those changes. Crop 12 envisioned 2.5 years, envisioned 2 years and 3 months to make these changes. Question 3, which passed in Massachusetts 2 years prior to Prop 12, had a January 1, 2020 date for promulgation of regulations. Massachusetts, just like California, has been unable to develop those regulations. Why? Because the people who wrote Prop 12 are not hog farmers. They're not veterinarians. They don't know what's in the best interest of the animal, and they have put forth ballot initiatives that are really difficult and very, very unworkable and difficult for the industry. Again, we can make the changes, but we need, as an industry, we need time to do those, to make those adjustments on the farm, to make sure the, you know, yes, the economics work. We've got a $25 billion a year industry. We employ, the last figure I saw was the pork industry is responsible for 500,000 jobs in rural America. There are a lot of people and a lot of communities that rely on the pork industry in this country. And so, yes, economics is a part of this because our nation's economy is a part of this. And that gets back to we need a reasonable time frame to do it. We still don't have regulations in Massachusetts. And they passed that in 2016, November 2016. We don't have any regulations from California. That was passed in November of 2018. And yet we're looking at an implementation date that's quickly coming up in 7 or 8 months, 7.5 months, January 1. And so what we're asking for now is, you know, is some more time to comply with this, but also, you know, these ballot initiatives are unconstitutional. California can't reach out into another state and dictate to that state how people there can do business.
Thank you, Michael. Any other comments to Chuck's question?
Hey, Jim, this is Terry again. I'll just one point, 2 points maybe, that, you know, the insinuation that California is thinking that we're doing it, our production practices that we raise animals in, is just because it's cheaper, couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, we have designed and built facilities that are extremely convenient to the animal, to the animal's livelihood. Animals, the productivity of our sow farms today, in my whatever 15, 20 years here in really ownership of operations, we've nearly put out 30% more pigs out of a sow today on an annual basis than we did 20 years ago. That doesn't happen because we don't take care of our animals. That couldn't be farther from the truth. And the other part nobody seems to want to talk about is worker safety. When you have animals loose in pens and watch them fight, worker safety and animal safety is top of mind for us. So to say we don't care, that just like rips my heart out.
Thank you, Terry. Any other comments? And just for clarity, I know it's probably hard for folks to keep track of who's speaking. That was Terry Walters, president-elect, and Michael Formica was the first person to respond to that Prop 12 question. Mayville, any other questions?
Yeah. Last question comes from the line of Bill Thompson from AgriPulse. Bill, your line is open.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Thanks for doing this. I guess it's kind of a three-part question. I'm just trying to get an update. I talked to Maria about this recently, but has there been, even if it's anecdotal, have there been any cases of chilled pork going bad at the ports because of the backups? Are any contracts being canceled because of the delays? And finally, does the Maritime Commission have, I know that they're doing this study or this whatever you want to call it, but do they actually have any authority to make these VOCCs, the shippers, stop agreeing to take empty containers back to China?
Maria?
Sure. Thanks for that, Bill. I'd say that right now we are continuing to see contracts being fulfilled on the chilled pork side. There have been some delays anecdotally on the frozen, but product is still flowing. However, the longer that this persists, the more that we could see backups occurring, just because, things will start, we could start seeing additional backups in the future, as happened a few years back. But I'd say that right now, to the second part of your question, we do believe that the FMC does have the authority over the carriers and the shippers. And that's why we're working with FMC, but also with members of Congress to help address some of these concerns that we have. And I think that there's a little bit more that can be done. Unfortunately, we are also stuck in a position where the FMC is switching chairmanship. So it's going to take the next chairman a little time to catch up, but we do believe that there is authority that the FMC does have to intervene in some of these cases.
Yeah, okay. Hey, can I ask a quick China question, seeing as I'm the last and you all want to hang up and go home, or maybe you are in your basement somewhere? Secretary Vilsack recently said that he was skeptical of Chinese comments that they had ASF under control. And we've seen a China report a couple of small outbreaks, but I'm wondering if anybody has a better handle on the situation. Is this just a couple of sporadic outbreaks, or is China heading back towards the problems they had before? And that's about it.
Hey, well, Jim, this is
hard to. Why don't
go
you
ahead,
that, Neil?
Well, no, I was just gonna say I was gonna throw it back at you and Liz, but Bill, I'll just tell you, this is Neil Dirk, CEO.
Yeah.
One of the things that's caught everybody's attention is, and as one industry advisor says, they don't believe anything that's published. They just watch the prices. However, you see the role of information that's come on, and what has a lot of people very concerned is that this is similar to what was stated publicly about a year and a half ago, that things were under control and things are going well. And look, the price of pork in China is declining. Last time we saw that happen, and indeed the price had gone down, was because there was a massive outbreak at the time, and people were rushing animals to market before the animals passed away. I am not saying that that's what's going on now, but the similarities on this is that it appears to have similarities to what we've seen in the past. There's no doubt the prices are going down. That would indicate that there's more meat available. But you again see anecdotal reports and others, and one has to be curious. Particularly, we have to remember the scale of China. They produced, before this event, they were 5 times larger than the U.S. as far as production. They've also been trying to change their landscape as it relates to the makeup of their production sector. They're going away from small holdings to large complexes. So we're watching it closely. But part of the thing that comes up is what I said about, is this history repeating itself, or is there progress being made and it's not significant? And I would say the jury's still out, but there are plenty of anecdotal reports that say that this has a long way to go to be under control. And I'll throw it to Maria or to Dr. Liz Wagstrom, our chief veterinary officer, for further comments.
Thanks, Ms. Dirks.
I think Neil said what I was going to say, but the only other part that I would add is that we're continuing to see China purchase large volumes of pork from countries all around the world. So from the trade data that we do have, we do know that they're continuing to purchase quite a significant amount of pork. Liz?
Yep, and I think both Neil and Maria just said exactly what I would have said. There's some lack of transparency on what's going on in China, but we have the indicators that it may not be, the outbreak may not be totally under control.
Hey, Bill, if I can make one other comment.
Always.
And that is, I mean, we all recognize, and our industry recognizes, that it's in China's best self-interest to produce more pork domestically, and that's their goal. How long that takes to do is yet to be seen. It's apparent from reports we've seen that they're putting emphasis in hog production. Anytime you see announcements made that the government is granting permission to large software companies to build hog farms, you go, wow, that's amazing. But again, remember, this is a country that in 1957 built the Great Hall of the Revolution, which is a massive building with wheelbarrows and bricks. And they set their minds to stuff and they can go forward. So anyway, just a perspective. We're monitoring and we'll see how it evolves.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. I think, Mayville, looks like we have one more question.
Yes, we have questions from Margaret C. Siegelman from Inside U.S. Trade.
Hi, thank you so much. Just one quick one. I was wondering, you mentioned non-tariff barriers in Vietnam as well as tariffs. Could you just speak a little bit more about what those are in particular and how significant you think they are to that market?
Sounds like another one for Maria Ziba.
Sure. I think that large part over the past few years, we've been working to address some of those non-tariff barriers. But one that comes to mind that we're still working on and continue to work on for a decade is a ban on white offal, which means that there are products like intestines, spleen, tongues. Those are the parts of the animal that aren't readily consumed in the United States, but we do have large consumption of that in Vietnam. There is an outright ban on those products. And I know that we had been working with USDA and USTR on this, and there was a partial ban lifted on red offal. But white offal remains one of those products that we're still interested in being able to export, but so far we're not able to. There's a couple of other issues, but I think that there's that one would probably be at the top of the list. There's other administrative requirements, but I think most importantly is for us to be competitive in the Vietnamese market. We have to be better at having better tariffs in that Vietnamese market. We're now paying double what our competitors pay at 15% for frozen pork versus the EU and the CPTPP countries that are at 7.5% for frozen pork. So I think that those are some of the issues that we can help address, and hopefully USTR will be able to address in the next in shortly.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I think we are almost at the top of the hour, and I think we have gotten to all the questions. Again, thanks to everybody who joined us today. You can always reach me, Jim Monroe, or Rachel Gantz, or Chloe Carson, the members of the NPPC communications team, for any additional questions, background, one-on-one interviews, all that good stuff. So again, thanks for attending. We hope to see many of you at World Pork Expo. And thanks again for joining. Bye, everybody.